Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with different miracles, with different books and the original pure messages. But at the same time, there have been some people around, okay, who did not have enough knowledge. So a kind of pessimism was created among the people around and the ummah and the community. Now the question is that, can people, for example, say that we want the pure religion of God or Allah on earth, and for us, without the names, I mean, without these labels of, for example, faqih or jurisprudence or Christianity, Judaism or Islam? Is it true?
Actually, this might be in vacuum, but underground, you don't have such a thing. Underground, because by religion, what do we mean by religion? In the previous session, we said the definition of religion is important because what is your expectation from religion? If your expectation is just to have a mere kind of spirituality in your life, you have some food, you have a car, you have a house, and also you need to have some spiritual feelings.
Yes.
Now here you may read some poems. You may read, you may do painting, you may go to some, you know, yoga classes, or you may have some religious experiences and practices. So if somebody is looking at the religion from that perspective, so yeah, they can do that, and lots of people do this. But if you believe in the life to come, I mean the hereafter, and if you believe that man is in a journey, and if you believe that man in this journey should achieve perfection, and if there is going to be any failure to achieve the perfection, then man is going to suffer because of that. And to get that and to have that, if we know that man doesn't have enough knowledge about it, then we see that we have to look for someone who can guide us in this journey. And we have to make sure that the one who is going to guide us, they know the journey and the well-being of man in the other realm of life, that we have no way to experience anything about it. Because in this world, we can experience things, and through, you know, test and error, we can find the way towards that. But we have not seen the life to come, and we have not, we don't have a knowledge. So the knowledge should come from Allah, from the God, from the one who has set up this journey for us.
Yes.
Then we have to make sure that the knowledge which is being given to us is pure one. And then how can we say that, so we have to make sure that the one who is teaching us, this is the pure knowledge. So here we cannot just play, you know, with the knowledge. So it matters a lot that if this religion, a specific religion, I don't want to mention the name, this or that, are giving me something, what is the authenticity for this? How can I trust on them? So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran says you have to worship God, and then he says ذَلَكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْحَقِّ, because Allah is the truth. Means that you have to make sure that whatever you are doing is, and whatever you are practicing is the truth. The people may differ according to the capacity they had, the potentiality which was there, the facilities which were possible at their disposal. They may reach to different levels of the truth. And if they have done their best, they are excused for that, for the missing part.
Okay.
But that is another issue. So we might have lots of people who purely, with very pure intention, they follow different religions, a type of people who have no bias against the truth if they find it.
Very good.
So those people are excused according to our understanding. The Quran says such people who are open to the truth, even if they happen not to find it, they are excused because they opened their hearts towards the truth and they looked for that the life, but they didn't have a chance. They were not lucky enough to find the truth.
Yes.
So those people are excused. But if somebody can find the truth, if there is a way for them, so they cannot just easily, you know, take it easy and to say that, okay, whatever comes around is okay.
Or at least there is an enmity between them or the concept of deen or religion of Allah, isn't it? I mean, they show oppression or something like that, or enmity towards a religion. Can we say that they are acting against their own fitra, isn't it?
No, I mean, we're talking about those people who look for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We say that if people are really looking for the truth, then they are excused. But
yes.
And if they fall short in finding it, and while they did their best, then they have a chance.
Uh-huh.
They have a chance to get something from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that people shouldn't be difficult. This is important. They shouldn't be difficult. But lots of the time, it happens that people are difficult against the truth.
Yes.
When it comes to my religion, my people, my nation, uh-huh. my label, my position. So the selfish issues, when it comes in, then you see that they marginalize the truth in the decision-making of human being. And here is the place that man is of no excuse.
Yes.
When they fail to find the truth and practice the truth.
Okay.
So one element, because why there are different religions and people differ in the way that they found the religions, I said usually after the prophets to come, there are people around that for their different intentions, sometimes they lacked enough knowledge, sometimes they had their own selfish issues. So they started different classes and schools within a religion, and they ignoring people, they didn't know which one to follow. So some people happen to follow this one, some others the other one. Here different schools of thought were formed, while if they really were about to be sincerely mm-hmm. looking for the truth, it might not be like that. Allah the Almighty had the intention to teach man in a gradual sense. So mm-hmm. there was a graduation in sending the message. Allah
yes.
considers all religions to be one religion and calls it Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And this Islam that was sent to Prophet Adam, and later on it was developed according to, as Quran says, Sharia, these do's and don'ts start from Nuh alayhi salam.
Okay.
Apparently, before Nuh, there is no Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of very simple okay. kind of religion.
That's right.
And it's gradually it expanded. At the time of Ibrahim alayhi salam, it expands more.
Yes.
The prophets of determination, each one coming, it's a kind of a turning point in
yes.
the Islam. And Prophet Muhammad, as the last one, he brought the full perfect form of Islam. The religion, when it comes, Allah calls it Islam, means to be submitted to Allah, to be in full submission to the God. But this comes in a process of a graduation and getting towards perfection.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Al-Mahmadi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of religion and the gradual perfection of the concept of religion. It was very kind of you, Sheikh.
Pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstudio.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan.
Iran's anti-ship missiles.
Part 3.
In the mid-1980s, Bandar Abbas. Although the aerial routes were very unsafe for passenger planes, and the Iraqi Ba'athist Air Force would attack any plane without any restrictions, the plane landed in Bandar Abbas, so then President Ayatollah Khamenei would get out of it. The Iranian president was there to inspect the newly established IRGC's naval forces capabilities. The forces were guarding the Iranian maritime borders in the Persian Gulf in the face of U.S. troops. Ayatollah Khamenei inspected a section where the IRGC experts were making silkworm missiles. The idea of reverse engineering the missiles that reached Iran from North Korea after going through a tortuous path had obsessed Iranian experts for a while. Further afield, one of the missiles was fired with Ayatollah Khamenei in attendance. Pretty soon, Iran equipped the fast fishing boats with air launch systems. It confronted the Iraqi and Kuwaiti battleships with the most basic weapons. It was in those days when the U.S. entered the Persian Gulf to protect Iraq's oil in the face of Iran's attacks. Saudi Arabia gave Iraq the thumbs up to use its airspace and AVAX telecommunications systems. The French Mirage with Iraqi pilots could fly for such a long distance that it could fly across the Persian Gulf and move back. The American AVAX spotted the Iraqi Mirage jets, but ordered the Saudi F-15 fighters not to show any reaction. But the aircraft wasn't the Mirage. It was a civilian Falcon that had the Exocet missile. The Iraqis were so eager to strike any ship on that sea that in an unprecedented incident, they fired two Exocet missiles towards the USS Stark ship. The commander on board the ship ordered both defense systems to remain on alert. The electronic warfare and shooting the missile at a close range were on complete standby, but it was too late. The first missile struck the ship in the middle of the hull and completely destroyed the body. Quite accidentally, the warhead of the missile did not go off and the Stark survived the first attack. But it wasn't that lucky in the second strike. The second warhead exploded and the ship was engulfed in fire. In the following years, Iran improved the newer missile from several aspects, including its range, radar, and the internal electronic warfare of the missile and its land radar. Meanwhile, the mass production of numerous coastal projectiles for the newer missile, equipped with three missiles. Later on, with the new radar installed on the projectile vehicles, had an important role in developing Iran's coast-based defense based on the cruise missiles. The new radar was installed to replace the old radar to boost the strength in electronic warfare. The autopilot digital system, the high-precision navigation system, the possibility of programming the missile before being fired, the possibility to strike targets with small cross-sections, advanced radar with the possibility of confrontation with electronic warfare, fast preparation and reaction of the missile are among the other features of this new missile. Ultimately, the Qadr missile was born. The U.S. has a similar missile, the AGM-86, with a range of over 2,400 kilometers. The air and land launch type of the missile, namely the Tomahawk, is very famous. The missiles were made so the U.S. could target the Soviet Union's territory from outside its borders. The AGM-86 is launched by long-haul and heavy aircraft like the B-52 bombers. It continues to fly in its direction for such a long distance until it finally finds its target with a speed of about 800 kilometers per hour and destroys its target near the ground. Over 100 projectiles fired this terrifying missile during the invasion of Iraq. It showed that Iran should have quickly moved towards possessing such a missile. However, owning the missile had several important requirements. Almost the entire route should have been recorded in aerial mapping and sent to the missile's memory, and the target should also be accurately mapped. It means the country that is going to fire the missile needs to precisely map the location of the target meter by meter. Cruise missiles for striking the targets on the ground should have the capability of flying near the ground, and flying over the grooves won't divert it. The power created a major challenge for defense systems. but the next phase was an aircraft that can fire the speedy monster. The U.S. does that with the B-52, but Iran does not need to fly all the way to the U.S. The region is dotted with U.S. military bases and vessels, so the old Sukhoi is more than enough to fire the cruise missiles. But does Iran have the capabilities for aerial mapping with the accuracy the cruise needs? The issue has to do with Iran's drone power. In 2007, for the first time, the Congress of the IRGC commanders witnessed an important development. They watched the live images of the movement of U.S. warships in the Persian Gulf. 17 years have passed since then, and Iran is the absolute power of the unmanned aircraft in the region. Therefore, mapping the routes and targets for such a country is no longer a daunting task. After a while, Iran unveiled the Huezi and Sumar. Sumar was so important that Uzi Rubin, the father of Israel's missile industry, said,
"So this is an achievement. This is a major technical achievement. It's not copying. It's not. It's even more difficult than designing a new one to do a good Chinese copy. So again, I take my hat off for the guys who did it technically."
The Abu Mahdi missile that was mentioned earlier was in fact the naval type of the Huezi missile. In fact, Iran had managed to develop one of the longest range cruise missiles in the world without spending much time or money. It's a possibility that long range air launch cruise, regardless of the fact whether it can target the ships or positions on the ground, is a member of the Sumar, Huezi, and Abu Mahdi family. But after a few months, an important image was published. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, in an exhibition displaying a large number of knowledge-based and innovative products, was inspecting a special engine. The engine was named the Ramjet. Ramjets are engines that lead the producing countries to the frontier of manufacturing hypersonic missiles. It means the horizon of Iranian missiles will be easily set 5 times faster than the speed of sound. Besides these weapons capabilities, Iran has shown since many years ago it's interested in making its land-to-land missiles guided.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. Here in the studio, we have Sister
Asma.
Sister Asma.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Assalamu alaikum.
And we have myself, Muzaffar Haider, at your service.
Thank you for yourself being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an
honor.
Of course,
same in here. Likewise. How do you define pain?
Pain, I don't know, like, you get injured in some way, I guess, and then there's pain receptors in your brain. It travels up your spinal cord, and then...
These days, everything is just like a trigger for pain. Everything
really?
Is painful.
Really?
Life has been so painful.
That sounds really awful and sad, sister. How is that?
When we're living in a world in which you have to see many things... like kids getting killed and you cannot do anything, then these images are going to create a pain inside your heart. And then this pain is going to get piled up because you cannot do anything.
Yeah.
Like, it might happen in a closer scale as well. Like, when you look around in your own city, I don't know, in your neighbors, you might see people who are suffering from poverty.
Yeah.
You see people suffering from a kind of a special disease or sickness, like a kind that does not have any cure.
Yeah.
And then everybody is suffering in a special, particular way.
Mm.
So all these things are pain. I know that there is a positive point to life as well, but I guess totally human beings have been created in pain.
Yeah.
That's actually the same notion that exists in the Holy Book of Quran. There is no way to separate people from pain. Like, that's a thing that has been interlaced with your soul.
Mm.
It's in your essence. And sometimes it has got good points to itself, like it would have some positive effects because it's going to let you think more. It's going to let you be more productive.
Right.
And sometimes, no, depending on the kind of person you are. Because sometimes we're so weaker than what we're feeling. There is a huge burden upon our shoulder, and those pains are going to be so destructive.
But which pain, you know, sometimes you have the pain of having to kind of suppress yourself for the sake of being accepted.
That's a different sort of pain, which is so sad and depressing.
Can you explain this? Like, I never understood it. Why would you, like, suppress yourself to be accepted by others? Is that something that I do? I'm trying to figure it out. I can't at the moment.
See, there is this maybe misunderstanding that might happen, in which if you become a kind person, you're not surpassing yourself in order to please other people. You're practicing what humanity has put inside of you as a burden.
Right.
Like, for example, if there is a person who always treats you wrong, you don't necessarily have to have a lot of interaction with those people. But when it happens, out of, I don't know, modesty, politeness, out of the fact that you do not wish anyone any harm, you try to be this philanthropist sort of a person who does not do any harm to other people. You keep it kind, and you just make it not look like it's a war in between you. These kind of people are not called people-pleasing kind of a person. The people-pleasing person would do anything to make everyone satisfied with them.
I see. Okay, well, if the ceiling was, like, falling down, it's gonna crush everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to suppress everybody. But then, like, you allow it to suppress you, and, like, it... Like, you hold it up so that everybody else can be okay. Is that still sacrificing? And that's, see what I mean? So I'm asking, like, how do you suppress yourself? Like, which part of yourself are you suppressing? Your personality, your mood?
Maybe it depends on your intention. The whole difference is going to be differentiated with your intention.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to recognize what you're doing is a kind of suppressing yourself as in a negative point. You try to cut yourself short. You try to swallow your character in order to get fit in a special context.
Okay.
This is going to be called suppressing yourself.
Okay, can you give me an example of when this has happened with you?
With me?
Yeah, because I need something practical here to...
I do not really... I rely too much on what other people might think of me. So, therefore, I don't think I'm a sort of a person who would do a lot of interaction with other people to get put in such a situation where I have to suppress myself. But there are situations in which, for example...
Because I think I'm pretty similar in that sense. Don't suppress myself. So, I think it's like maybe we're not qualified to talk about this. You know?
Well, we have seen examples, but the problem is that sometimes examples are not on top of your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
But we can relate to the things we just imagine in our own mind. Like, for example, there are people who would, like, you have to forget about your dignity to go for some special sort of actions or jobs or interaction with other people, they do it because of the fact that they just want to be an accepted person in that society, mm-hmm. in that context, mm-hmm. in that group of people. Like, I know these group of friends are not so much of good people, but since they are the prominent groups in, for example, among the relatives or in the school or at the university, I try to get close to them. I try to make myself a part of them, forgetting about all my rules, all my borders, forgetting about my dignity, most importantly.
Mm-hmm.
I forget about my character just to get accepted according to the norms of some special group of people.
But you still didn't give me a practical example from your...
It's because I told you, I just don't remember a practical example, but these are close, I guess. So, just as we're thinking about a practical example, let's go for a break, and then we'd be back.
Anyway, Muslims wash themselves in the bathroom, right? After mm-hmm. they use the toilet, they wash themselves. But this is very, very embarrassing to explain to your school friends when you're around 10 to 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always like, I can't go to the toilet in the school. Boys' toilet in a school in the UK.
Of course
they're the, not. They are the worst places in the world. They are disgusting. So yeah, you can't use it. And then one time I was having a discussion with my friends and I was like, yeah, so yeah, but you do wash yourself when you go to the shower, right? And they were like, no, we don't wash ourselves there either. And I was so shocked and disgusted that this is, see, cleanliness is looked down upon, right? In that sense. And it's just, I can't believe it. Anyway, when Corona came and then everybody was like, scrambling over each other for toilet paper. You remember that yeah. was happening in the West and they were just going crazy over toilet paper and they were like pushing over old ladies in the supermarkets to just like get their toilet rolls and stuff. At that time, many of the Muslims, well, I know one brother in the UK
mm-hmm.
and he was like, listen, he told his white non-Muslim friends, just wash yourselves. And he gave them one of those, we call it a lota. It's like a thing. Because they don't have hoses over there, do they? Over here in Iran, most yeah. houses have like these hose pipes. Over there, you don't have that. So you have to have this kind of jug or bottle next to the thing. It's called a lota. And then he gave that to his white non-Muslim friend. And he said, use this. And he was so thankful. You know, so... After a long time, you gain this maturity and you start to understand that you can actually be yourself. And you should
express yourself.
Yeah. In reality, I should have had the courage to be there, like, you guys are disgusting. You don't even wash yourselves.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And therefore, I was suppressing myself in order to just fit in.
Yeah. And I guess that happens a lot when you are when you're younger. When you're out of school, this might happen a lot because you do not have the courage to stand for yourself, to speak up, to express yourself. And just as I said, you want to be accepted by the majority of your classmates, by the majority of people who have impact in that society. So that's why you forget about your own self, mm-hmm. your own character, just to get fit in.
Yeah.
Which I guess as you get older, you would understand that the only thing that you have to fit in are the rules that are set by Allah. And all the restrictions and rules that are there and have been planned for us and have been clarified for us by the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, just speaking of the notion of misfit, we already know that sometimes the things we believe in, which are right, are not accepted by the majority of people. And those majority of people are not going to be the criteria for what we are doing. The criteria is only what Allah has set for us and whatever the Holy Book of Quran is telling us. That's the only thing we have to stick to.
Mm-hmm.
The other stuff, like what these people are going to think of me, like what these majority of people are going to be enemy against me, these things are not going to matter too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And we should not care about it too much. Mm-hmm, we should not put too much of emphasis on that.
Yeah.
Like, try to accept this very fact that sometimes you alone is going to make too many changes and you do not have the approval of all the people and of all the members of society. Mm-hmm. If you're doing the right thing, then express yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And do not let go of it just because or in the expense of the fact that, okay, don't just let it go just because the majority of people do not approve of it.
Yeah.
Also, we have it in the Holy Book of Quran that it is not with the number of people that the change is going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's with how decisive you are and how right is the intention that you have.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are just a small group of people who wish to do something and they're not approved by other people in the society, but eventually and in the end, they are going to make everyone believe in what they say. Or mm-hmm. even if not that, then God is enough. The fact that He is satisfied with you is the only thing that matters.
So yeah, that's it, guys. Be brave and bold in what you believe in. Never be shy. And you know, it's often the thoughts that you have in your mind are often the right thoughts. And remember, it all goes back to that internal hujjah, which is actually pointing you in the right direction. And sometimes you find yourself in a society or amongst people who are doing the opposite of what is right, and you need to have the courage to say, this is wrong.
Exactly.
At the same time, you need to recognize that sometimes the society that you're living in is actually doing the right thing, and it's on the right direction. Inshallah, may we find such a society. In that case, we need to be with the jama'ah and with the congregation.
Very true.
That's all we have time for. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers.
an Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. To all our brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the questions and issues pertaining to the Islamic upbringing of children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And in the studio to help us with our questions, we have our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salaam alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, so it's been a few episodes we've been talking about the importance of storytelling and using storytelling to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as role models to our children. You've given us a few factors that we have to consider when we're telling stories to children, such as keeping the sentences short, using simple vocabulary, having a body language and a tune which is in sync with the story. Sometimes we have to speak fast, sometimes slow, sometimes shout, sometimes whisper, to get the children involved in the story, to repeat the story a million times if they want it. It's okay, they'll love it, and to appreciate and acknowledge their understanding of the story, but without asking them directly. So in the last few episodes, you've been giving us some samples of how to tell stories, and in every sample, there's been something special. The last thing that we covered was how to narrate a story about miracles about the Ahlul Bayt or their spirituality. What are we going to be talking about today?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we're discussing about how it's very important to introduce the Ahlul Bayt properly, right? To our children, but also to others as well. And one of the mistakes, unfortunately, that we've been doing for the past maybe 10, 20, 30 years as being influenced by a very secular and non-religious Western ideology is that we introduce the Ahlul Bayt. I'm sorry if I'm being a bit frank, but This is a reality out there. If you see how we introduce, us Shias introduce the Ahlul Bayt to the world, is that we introduce the Ahlul Bayt only with their worldly traits, right? The traits of being generous, kind, respectful, seeking justice, being strong. These are all things that others, all of us have, right? Now you could say they were a bit better than all of us, right? But at the end of the day, this is not, firstly, it's not the complete picture of the Ahlul Bayt. Right, so you're actually taking one side and leaving the other. And secondly, it's not enough for them to be our role model. It's not enough for them to be able to be those people that are going to hold our hands and take us upwards, because we brought them down. And in the context that we're talking about, and let me make this bold and underlined and in red, that these are not the kind of people that will be in competition with the role models that they have in the cartoons and the animations that they're watching. Right, if we want to remove Ben 10 and Spider-Man and Superman as the role models of our children, okay, you need to introduce to them individuals and personalities that are, one, real, two, that are also spiritual and otherworldly and have superpowers as well, okay. And more important, and why you're going to win this battle if you do it properly, is that because the Ahlul Bayt are fitri.
Okay, so we're going to have to take a break here and we'll discuss this issue more. We'll be back. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So if you remember on the last episode, we were talking about the story of Imam Ali lifting the door of a fort with one hand while 20 to 30 Muslims collaborating together could barely lift it off the ground. And one issue here was that maybe the children will not believe it, or maybe will make them the Ahlul Bayt so super that it will be impossible to reach them. And just before the break, so you were saying that one mistake in introducing the Ahlul Bayt is bringing them down to a level where they're just a little bit better than us. Can you explain more about this?
So the Ahlul Bayt, because they're connected to Allah, and they're the closest creation that Allah has created to him, and Allah has given the Ahlul Bayt everything that is possible to give to a creation, from knowledge, power, strength, etc. And so these spiritual values are extremely important for them to be our role models and our guide to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? Put it this way, that the Ahlul Bayt have come from up there to take us up. I think it's a good picture to have, right? That Allah sends these messengers, and they're from the highest levels of perfection and spirituality, but they're brought down to hold our hand and to take us up with them. For that to happen, we need to follow them. We need to take them as role models. We need to be like them, right? And if we want to be like them, we have to really love them. For us to love them, they have to be our role models, and we have to know about that particular aspect. The moment we cut that rope, okay, and we make them only worldly creations, okay, that they're just very courageous and seeking justice and very nice and polite, etc., etc., okay, that's it. If that's all they are, they will never become those guides that we want us to take us up there, right? So this is a crucial point, right? And so we shouldn't make this mistake with children either. When we introduce the Ahlul Bayt to the children, we have to tell them about the true reality of the Ahlul Bayt. Yes, I'm not saying don't talk about their generosity, don't talk about their kindness, their love for others. No, those are very important points as well. But also talk about how they're connected to Allah. And also talk about how those luminous creation that once we love them, once we have them as role model, they take us up with them. One of the things that what happens is that we're scared that if we talk about these supernatural aspect of the Ahlul Bayt, they won't be a role model for us. I'm sure you've heard about this, that the Ahlul Bayt lived 1,400 years ago. They were a completely different world. And now you want to add to that they had superpowers. That makes us very far away from them. And how can I take them as role models then? That's a question that you would ask. There's two answers to that. One is that, we mentioned this before, is that they're fitri. Right? If you remember the hadith that I mentioned, that in our fitra we have the Ahlul Bayt, their knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt. If you read Ziyad Jamia Kabira as well, you'll find there as well that there's no creation out there that doesn't know the Ahlul Bayt. Just that we get distracted, we forget, and this is another discussion for later. But the other thing is that, let me ask a question over here. You know Robin Hood, right? And you know Spider-Man. Both Robin Hood and Spider-Man were characters that help others, right? But if I ask you which one's more attractive, which one's the one that's going to be more of a role model, and which one's the one that children are going to be like, I want to be like him.
I think it would be Spider-Man.
Spider-Man. Why is this the case? You think about it, you realize that Robin Hood is a normal guy. All he's doing is just taking money from the rich and giving to the poor. He's not doing anything special. There is no supernatural in Robin Hood. But the moment you bring Spider-Man in, with all the supernatural powers that he has, it suddenly becomes a role model. It suddenly becomes really attractive. Now children want to be like Spider-Man. They dress like Spider-Man. They want to act like Spider-Man. You even have cases of children trying to jump from very high walls thinking they're Spider-Man. That's how close and that's how effective this role model is. That you have children jumping from high walls and they nearly die and get really badly injured. Okay? Because they take them as role models. The key was what? Was the fact that he had superpowers.
Okay, let's take a break, and after the break we'll be back to discuss this point more. Don't go away.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about whether it's all right to introduce the super spiritual aspect of the Ahlul Bayt. So just before the break, you said that, for instance, if we compare Spider-Man with Robin Hood, Robin Hood was a very normal person who was taking money from the wealthy and giving it to the poor, but Spider-Man had all these super cool capabilities, and children are more attracted to Spider-Man rather than Robin Hood. Now, let's compare Spider-Man with the Ahlul Bayt in the aspect that Spider-Man's superpowers come from being bitten by a spider, something that in a child's mind says, it could happen to me if I'm lucky enough. But when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt, their superpowers is given to them by God, and they are designated people, special designated people. We even tell our children that their lights existed from before the creation of man. So it's not something that is attainable for children. You cannot get bitten and then have these super spiritual powers. Could this be something that is disattractive for children? It's not something I can do, so.
No, on the contrary. I think children realize that there are no spiders out there that could give the superpowers of Spider-Man. And if they do think that, it's a mistake of parents to allow that to the extent that they start now thinking that Spider-Man is real, right? When children become 6, 7, 8, even though they take them as role models, they know that this is not real, right? But when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt, it's a different story. One, because it's fitri. I keep coming back to this, right?
It's innate.
We've been created like that. And number two is that actually it's possible to be like them, right? It's actually a reality out there that we actually believe, right, in our faith, that we can be like the Ahlul Bayt. Yes, we might not be able to reach that the extent of perfection that they have, but we can reach a lot of the things that they have. And this is what we need to tell the children. When I say teach the children about the supernatural aspect of the Ahlul Bayt, that doesn't mean you tell them that that's something you can never reach. No, on the contrary. You tell them that's something you can reach as well. Perhaps not to that extent, but you want to make them attach to them that you want them to want to be like the Ahlul Bayt in all the aspects. And this will happen, right? Our ulama and our scholars who are very close to the Ahlul Bayt, they very much look like the Ahlul Bayt. They would do things that the Ahlul Bayt would do, right? So it's very, very possible to be like the Ahlul Bayt, and it's a reality, it's possible to do it. Unlike Spider-Man, where it's not possible. So if we do introduce the Ahlul Bayt properly, then actually they're 100 times more attractive as role models than any superhero that you see on animation, because that's fantasy, this is real.
And what do you do if your children start placing doubts on these stories as they grow up, from what they hear from the community?
The reason why they will put doubts in these things is outside influence, right? From stories itself, if you've presented them properly, and if you've done the Islamic upbringing properly, then doubts are not created just like that, because those are reality, and doubts can be answered, right? As they grow older, let's say they come up with questions and they're trying to say, maybe it's not possible. This usually happens maybe they're 9, 10, 11 onwards, basically. Then this is stories where when you take this aspect of role model, which is very much associated with love and kind of an awe, right? That will now need to slowly have a very rational aspect to it as well. This is where the rational comes in. So if you want to take it like this, that we're trying to do an Islamic upbringing and bring the children foundations towards them becoming a true servant of Allah. From a very young age, when you start introducing the Ahlul Bayt, you make it a very emotional and an admiration for the Ahlul Bayt. You build this seed in them that they have this love, this positive association, this amazement of the Ahlul Bayt, that we want to be like the Ahlul Bayt, right? Just like they do for Ben 10 and Superman, right? They want to be like them without trying to understand, like, where did they come from, right? If you ask a child, if you ask a 4-year-old or 5-year-old, how did they get these powers or understand powers, they won't understand, right? But they still want to be like them. Similar for the Ahlul Bayt. But when they grow older and older, they start to rationalize this thing, then you also bring the rational behind it. Explain to them rationally, what do these things mean, right? Obviously, to their own level, the way you speak to a 9-year-old is different the way you speak to a 13-year-old, right? But this is where now you bring the rational aspect. And because you've got the love and the emotional aspect set in, you add the attraction, you add the rational understanding to it, you've got a complete full picture then.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. If you missed the episode, don't worry, you can always download an archive of this episode and our previous ones. Simply visit our website, parstoday.com, that's parstoday.com, and find us on the Call of Islam page. You can also email us at iribenglishradio@irib.ir, that's iribenglishradio@irib.ir, or you can reach out to us directly through our social media accounts. Simply search Call of Islam Radio on Twitter, YouTube, Telegram, and Facebook. That's Call of Islam Radio. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be showcasing how the tactics deployed by Palestine Action has successfully derailed yet another UK-based Israeli arms company. Latifa Abu Chakra has been looking at Palestine Action's remarkable record of success and has this report.
The mighty Palestine Action has struck again. After years of targeting Elbit Systems subsidiary Elite KL in Tamworth, Staffordshire, the infamous Direct Action Group has succeeded in shutting down the arms site for good. Elite KL in Tamworth used to produce cooling units for Israeli tanks and parts for Israeli military vests. Now, they are no longer owned by Elbit. The factory makes cooling units for buses and trains in Europe. But how was this victory achieved? Palestine Actionists occupied the roof and dismantled the premises repeatedly, which led to increased security costs for the company, cutting the profits of the subsidiary by 75%. The expense of security included several months of lost wages. While the site was protected, the roof was restored, and a security perimeter was established. Their plant had to be sold due to declining revenues, and the new owners promptly wrote to Palestine Action to indicate that they had severed all ties with Elbit and that their board had decided to stop all contracts for the production of armaments. It will never succeed to beg the oppressors, the British politicians, and the Israeli arms trade to end their collaboration. But Palestine Action does not wait for approval to push action until victory. Only 4 Elbit weapon sites remain in Britain, and if they continue on their current course, it won't be long before they are all gone. At their 2024 annual investor conference, the Elbit CEO complained of supply chain disruptions caused by 2 things. 1, the blockade of the Red Sea by the Yemeni armed forces, and 2, the disruptions to their supply chain and the reluctance of companies in Europe to work with them, caused by the operations of Palestine Action. Palestine Action has successfully shut down 3 Israeli arms sites in Britain, cost Elbit over 280 million in lost contracts with the Ministry of Defence, and broken through the lines of state-controlled activism in the UK.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm pleased to welcome back Loki as a guest contributor today. He's a celebrated British Iraqi hip-hop artist and hosts the Watchdog Posca podcast for Mint Press News. The Watchdog investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. He's one of the UK's most prominent supporters of the Palestinian struggle and one of the country's most outspoken critics of the Zionist entity. Welcome to the show. David, just tell us, what's so special about Palestine Action?
Well, Palestine Action is the organisation in this country which takes the radical view that we have to actually directly interfere with the support for the genocide in Gaza. They don't just go on demonstrations, they don't just boycott things, they actually physically destroy arms factories. And as you see in the report, they've had yet another victory. And this is the real cutting edge of Palestine solidarity work, which is in favour, of course, of Palestine liberation, not just of the question of solidarity. And that's what makes them different to other parts of the movement.
Mm. Well, Loki, what explains Palestine Action's success in Tamworth then? And just tell us, how did they do it?
First, I think it's important to establish that Palestine Action is the tip of a spear. And behind that spear is the passions of hundreds of thousands, at very least, of the population in this country who are viscerally opposed to Zionism in Palestine and are seeking to disrupt the passage of the Zionist project. Now, in terms of Tamworth, the reason that this succeeded was you saw Palestine Action more than a few times occupy the roof of Elite KL in Tamworth, and people from the local community gather around the factory to support the actionists on the roof. They deconstructed the roof, and then what happened afterwards was the company had to spend quite a lot on erecting a barrier around the factory to protect it and spend a lot more on security. And ultimately, it became a no-brainer for the company. They realized that their presence in the community was more of an expenditure than was in their interest, and also was ultimately untenable. When you also looked at the drop in profits for the company caused by all of the expenditure on security, it really became an impossible circle to square, really, in the case of Tamworth Elite KL. And so Elbit shut down the subsidiary, and the new owners of the factory told Palestine Action directly that they are no longer involved with Elbit Systems. Clearly, this campaign has rendered Elbit Systems quite the toxic brand in this country among communities. And it's led to many communities across the country withdrawing their consent to the production of Israel's weapons of war in their vicinity.
Well, David, just to say a word or two then, will you, about the wider pro-Palestinian movement and where they stand on the activities of Palestine Action?
Well, I think there's two questions there. One is, which Loki's just touched upon, which is the wider support in the country for the work of Palestine Action. And that's very widespread. The vast bulk of the population knows there's a genocide happening in Gaza, is opposed to it, and supports action to be taken against that genocide. But when you come to some key elements of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, in particular organisations like the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, then they are less keen on supporting Palestine Action. In fact, you could say that they have been involved directly in trying to sabotage Palestine Action's activities, and that's really very worrying. I mean, there ought to be a broad solidarity across all the parts of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, since we're all supposed to be on the same page, and it shouldn't be the case that organisations like PSC, or at least the head of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, should be engaged in sabotage actions against what is clearly the most effective Palestine Solidarity operation in the country.
What's the motivation then, do you think, for that? I mean, who are they trying to impress by not supporting Palestine Action?
In the end, who they are impressing is the Zionists. But it's a much more complicated question than that, of course. And there are all sorts of relationships between PSC, for example, and the Palestinian Authority, etc. So those kinds of questions in there.
Yeah, right. Well, Loki, what other examples then are there for direct action actually delivering tangible results in British history, would you think?
Well, of course, in the British context, you have the very example of people that do not own property being able to elect parliamentary representatives. The Chartists had to struggle for over 300 years.